September 1960. A sturdy bungalow sat quiet at the end of a residential street in the London suburbs. But as the evening sun set, there was a knock on the door. Helen Kroger grabbed a book from the kitchen as her husband Peter opened the door. It was Ruth Search from down the block. To what did they owe this unexpected visit? Peter's voice was warm and boisterous, and just a bit forced. Helen disappeared back into the kitchen. Ruth had baked them a pie, fresh out of the oven. She was so grateful to have such kind and caring neighbors. The way they doted on her kids, asking about their schoolwork and giving them treats, it was just so appreciated. Helen reappeared next to her husband, her book nowhere in sight. Peter and Helen thanked Ruth for the lovely pie. They'd certainly enjoy it tonight. Ruth bid them good night and left. Helen and Peter, meanwhile, cut slices of pie and waited. Finally, another knock, and this time it was the visitor they'd been expecting. Helen once again retrieved her book. Her book of ciphered Russian messages. Helen and Peter weren't your ordinary middle-aged couple. They were spies. Their real names were Morris and Lona Cohen. This is Espionage, the new podcast original exploring the missions behind the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. I'm your host, Carter Roy. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. New episodes come out every Friday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. This is our second and final episode on two of the world's most infamous atomic spies, Morris and Lona Cohen. Morris and Lona were American-born activists turned communists and eventually Soviet spies. In 1945, the couple provided the Soviet Union with a complete diagram and description of the Allied atomic bomb, expediting the development of Russia's own A-bomb and giving them a substantial advantage during the Cold War. Last week, we explored how Morris and Lona Cohen went from agitated Americans to devout communists to dedicated and shrewd Russian operatives. This week, we'll follow them as they're forced to flee the United States. We'll learn about their new roles as Russian spies in Britain and their ultimate capture. Morris Cohen was honorably discharged from the U.S. Army on November 6, 1945. He was 35 years old, and Lona nearly 33. They returned to their unassuming life in a small apartment on East 71st Street. Lona found a part-time job in a library. Veterans were offered free college tuition, so Morris chose to pursue his master's degree in education at Columbia University. And that was all they were doing. Morris and Lona had been deactivated. Their intelligence work was completely on ice. Around the same time that Morris was discharged, two Soviet intelligence agents defected. One was Igor Sergeyevich Guzienko, a cipher clerk at the Soviet embassy in Ottawa. Guzienko had been recalled to Moscow, but he was intent on staying in Canada to provide a better life for his family. So he came forward with more than 100 documents proving that Canadian officials had been secretly passing intelligence to the Soviets. The second defector was Elizabeth Bentley. In February of 1945, the Moscow Center relegated her to a dead-end clerical job. Angry and humiliated, she turned herself over to the FBI 9 months later and told them everything she knew about Soviet operations in the U.S. In an effort to mitigate further exposure, Morris and Lona were instructed to cease all covert activity, destroy any evidence of their espionage, and maintain ignorance if questioned by the FBI. They remained sidelined for 2 years, until the Moscow Center once again needed their talent. It was the spring of 1947. Morris made his way home from the university. He and Lona had just sat down to supper when a knock on the door rang out. A courier with a letter. Not so unusual in the 1940s, but as Morris went to close the door, the courier offered a few extra words. Morris stopped in his tracks. He squinted, looking the young man up and down. Could it be? He asked the courier to repeat himself, and the man did, whispering a phrase so specific, only Morris and Lona would recognize it. Before they had been deactivated, their handler, Anatoly Yatskov, had given them a password, something by which they could be contacted in the future. And that was the password. Morris and Lona tore into the note. They were being summoned to Paris to discuss an important matter, summoned by their Soviet masters. The long hiatus was over. Finally, they could get back to serving the communist cause. That summer, Morris and Lona were flown to Paris at Russian expense. There, they were reunited with Anatoly Yatskov, their former handler. They took their seats across from him in a dimly lit office and listened intently as he brought them up to speed. After Lona's successful delivery of Allied atomic plans in her already infamous tissue box operation, another Soviet agent, Klaus Fuchs, was tasked with obtaining a written description of the atomic bomb. However, this description didn't reach Moscow until October 1945 and was still missing crucial information. Despite having obtained a decent amount of intelligence, the Russians were still far behind the Allies in the development of atomic weaponry. The Soviets were convinced that the Allies were planning a nuclear war, and the successful development of their own weaponry was a top priority. Moreover, they suspected the Allies had moved on to developing a hydrogen bomb, or H-bomb. While an atomic bomb's blast effect was measured in thousands of kilotons of TNT, an H-bomb could be measured in up to millions of kilotons of TNT. Moscow wanted information on the H-bomb immediately. But this was easier asked than done. The Coens returned home from Paris at the end of the summer of 1947. They resumed their activity as couriers and recruiters, this time under the guidance of a new control officer, Yuri Sokolov. Available Soviet documents aren't too clear on what exactly was accomplished. Perhaps their missions were thwarted. Perhaps the U.S. government crackdown on spying made it difficult to find new sources. What is evident is that while the Coens' dedication to the cause remained strong, Moscow grew frustrated with the lack of progress from their camp. Perhaps a new control officer would help. The Moscow Center replaced Sokolov at the end of 1948. Morris and Lona's new supervisor would be William August Fischer, an older and more experienced officer. But even under Fischer's guidance, they made little progress. And on top of that, every day brought increased tension and higher stakes to the Coens' espionage efforts. Antagonism between Soviet and U.S. atomic projects was growing exponentially. Considering that the FBI was now aware the Soviets had infiltrated the Manhattan Project, they would not rest until they figured out how and took down every Soviet operative involved. It didn't take long for their efforts to put the Coens in imminent danger. The reality set in one sweltering New York night in June 1950 during a tense meeting at Morris and Lona's apartment on 71st Street. Sokolov, the Coens' former control officer and constant friend, had been sent to visit his former assets on a risky but necessary visit. He scribbled down his messages on paper. Lona burned the notes as he wrote them. Morris sipped on a glass of water, doing his best to stay calm and collected. None of them risked speaking, in case the apartment had already been bugged. Sokolov explained that the FBI were following intel from the defections of Bentley and Guzienko. Their search led them to British physicist Klaus Fuchs, who had helped develop the Allied atomic bomb and passed along information to the Soviets while doing so. Once apprehended, Fuchs immediately confessed and directed the FBI towards his then-courier, Harry Gold, who admitted his involvement as well. Gold led the FBI to another courier, David Greenglass, and his sister and brother-in-law, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. Now they were in the clutches of the FBI. The Rosenberg spy ring had been rolled up. According to the Spy Museum, a roll-up occurs when an operation goes bad and an agent is arrested. Agents were dropping like flies. It was only a matter of time before the trail led back to the Coens. Morris and Lona needed to leave the United States immediately. Morris replied that they still had a chance to do more work for Moscow. They were fighters, and they'd fight on, he insisted, for the communist cause. But Sokolov shook his head. This was no time for discussion. He had his instructions, and now they had theirs. So ended the meeting. The Coens had no choice but to acquiesce. Still, they were casual in their preparations. After years of possible exposure, they couldn't quite fathom just how different this time might be. First, they cashed their savings bonds. Then, Morris returned home to the Bronx to say goodbye to his parents, telling them that he'd been offered a good writing job in California. This was the same story they offered their friends at a going-away party. But one night, the reality of their compromised state made itself gravely apparent. While the exact details are unknown, it's clear that something startled the Coens. Perhaps they'd been visiting with friends. Perhaps they'd gone for a walk. And perhaps they'd been returning from the store when they saw them. Men in suits, outside of their building, waiting for them. Morris and Lona made their way around the corner, casually, not hesitating in front of their door for a moment. This was the moment they'd been trained for. And hearts pounding in their chests, they knew exactly their next step. They had to leave now. But there was a problem. Lona turned to Morris, panicked. She wasn't wearing proper clothes. It would look strange if they were traveling in the wrong clothes. Morris opened his mouth to argue that time was more important, but the sound of footsteps nearby reminded him they didn't have the luxury of a discussion. He nodded, gesturing for Lona to follow him. Jack Bioja, Morris's friend from his time fighting for the loyalists in Spain, opened his front door to find the Coens looking rather frazzled. Lona explained that they had to leave on an unexpected trip, but she didn't have proper clothes. Would it be possible to borrow something from Jack's wife? Though it seemed a bit odd, Jack's wife, of course, agreed. Then, with Lona in her new dress, the Coens fled the United States, never to return. But the law already had their scent. Coming up, Morris and Lona assume the identities of Peter and Helen Kroger. Now back to the story. In 1950, Soviet agents Lona and Morris Cohen were forced to flee the United States. The capture of the Rosenberg spy ring had left them susceptible to exposure. The United States was no longer safe for them. They arrived in Moscow in 1951, where they were forced to flee once again. Stalin was on a hunt for Jews, so Russia wasn't safe either, despite their service to the country. Still, the Coens brushed off the betrayal. This was a temporary political conflict, not the real face of communism. They remained committed to their ideology and their work towards supporting it. At least the Moscow Center, the USSR's intelligence headquarters, still knew their value. the center sent them to Poland, where it got Morris a cover job teaching English. Then, in 1955, they were relocated once again, this time to England, where their new identities were Peter and Helen Kroger, an ordinary suburban couple. It was a hot summer evening in 1957. The Kroger's home in Ruislip, just outside London, was full, and the air was dense with body heat. But it didn't matter. The company was good. Helen Kroger set out appetizers, and Peter refilled drinks. They were an amiable couple, and had quickly become the town matriarch and patriarch. The neighborhood children often played in the Kroger's backyard while snacking on Auntie Helen's homemade cookies. Well, they did have a couple of odd quirks. Helen claimed to love photography, but the photographs she shared with friends weren't very good. Certainly not good enough to merit converting the bathroom into a dark room. And they did keep their lights burning late on Saturdays. But apparently, Peter's antiquarian book business had orders that needed filling. Well, despite these oddities, they seemed to be lovely people. This particular evening, Helen chatted with the women and Peter fired up a game of bridge with the men. Then, Peter glanced at the clock. His program was on. He made his way over to the radio while Bill Search dealt the cards. Several men raised their eyebrows as Peter turned the dial to Radio Moscow. One gentleman joked about Peter spying for the Russians. The group of men shared a hearty laugh at the thought. Peter himself offered a witty response. None of the neighbors suspected that the innocent remark was wholly truthful. Peter and Helen Kroger, formerly Morris and Lona Cohen, were not just in Ruislip to play cards. They were there on assignment. They had been tasked with collecting details on British underwater weaponry, and then coding or ciphering that intelligence for Moscow. According to the International Spy Museum, ciphering is a system for disguising a message, either by replacing its letters with other letters or numbers, or by shuffling them. The Krogers worked hand-in-hand with Gordon Lonsdale, a Russian who worked at the Admiralty Underwater Weapons Establishment at Portland. His agents on the inside of the establishment were Harry Houghton and Ethel G. Houghton, a communist sympathizer, worked as a clerk at the naval base. There, he successfully romanced G, who had top-level military clearance. He then convinced her to photograph classified documents for him, many on the sonar technology Britain was developing for its nuclear submarines. He gave her plenty of reason to do so. First, there was the cash, but then there was the patriotism. He told her the British Royal Navy was cheating the U.S. Navy out of the information she was providing, but he was rectifying the situation by passing the documents to the U.S. Her efforts would facilitate the flow of information between Britain and America, who needed each other as close allies, after all. This was in the interest of everyone, Brits and Americans. Well, this tactic is known as false flag recruitment. G believed she was helping the Yanks, when in reality, Houghton was passing her photographs to Lonsdale, and her efforts were supporting the Reds. Lonsdale, in turn, was passing the documents to the Cohens, who were coding them. At first, the operation seemed to be going swimmingly. But while the Cohens and their accomplices were busy smuggling British naval secrets to the Soviets, another critical arrest occurred back in the U.S. On June 21, 1957, Willie Fisher, who had acted as one of the Cohens' New York control officers, was apprehended. The FBI and U.S. immigration agents raided his room and discovered $4,000 and two photographs, one of a man and one of a woman. This couple would later be identified as Morris and Lona Cohen. The FBI would send wanted flyers of the couple to every NATO nation. But perhaps the flyers were lost in London's shuffling paperwork or buried under more pressing reports, because for reasons still unknown, the leads were not investigated in Britain. At least, not yet. Meanwhile, in Ruislip, just outside of London, the Coens were hard at work, none the wiser. It was an ordinary Saturday night in 1958. The community of Ruislip had retired to their respective homes for the evening. Peter Kroger situated himself in front of the television while Helen finished preparing dinner. Then, a visitor. Peter opened the door and found a smiling Gordon Lonsdale. What a pleasant surprise. But it wasn't a surprise at all. Lonsdale was right on time. The scene played out like a movie script. Lonsdale quipped that he was in the neighborhood and thought he'd see if they had room for one more at dinner. He loved Helen's cooking. Peter warmly replied that they'd be honored for him to join. Peter took Lonsdale's coat and invited him in. They gathered around the dining table once Helen had finished preparing supper, sharing a bit of small talk over the meal. But this is where the script ended. They weren't here for pleasantries, not really. There was real work to be done. Gordon reached into his pocket and retrieved a roll of film. Film containing G's pictures of secret naval documents from Portland. This was Helen's cue. She got up to clear the table, taking the roll of film with her. After a stop in the kitchen, she made her way over to the bathroom. The bathroom she had converted to a darkroom. Expertly, she developed the film. When it was dry, she would put it under a micro-dot camera and photograph it again. According to the Spy Museum, a micro-dot camera is a tiny, easy-to-hide device that can photograph documents and produce reproductions less than a millimeter in diameter. A micro-dot is so small, an entire document can be reduced to the size of a punctuation mark in a newspaper. Once the film was developed into a strip of micro-dots, Peter inserted the strip into the spines of books. The ones he claimed were part of his book business, wrapped them up, and addressed them to some special customers he had on the European continent. Then, he wrote a message informing the Moscow Center what he was sending. Sending a message to Moscow was quite a process, involving many steps to ensure a secure delivery. After coding and ciphering his message, Peter further disguised it by putting it into recorded Morse code using a special tape recorder called a burst encoder. Now, the burst encoder was then plugged into a shortwave radio transmitter, which sent the message over the air to Moscow at very high speed, over 200 words per minute. This reduced the airtime for each message to just seconds. Luckily, because the shortwave radio transmitter interfered with the neighbors' radios and televisions. Each time Morris plugged in the burst encoder, he hoped that no one noticed their TV screen blinking in and out. This was the Kroger's Saturday night routine. This is why they kept to themselves on the weekends, and this is why their lights were always on so late into Saturday evening. But they weren't the only ones with secrets. The law was getting closer to their little bungalow. In the spring of 1958, a letter was sent to the CIA field office in Berlin, alerting officials of two Russian spies stationed in Britain. The unknown defector signed his letter Heckenschütze, German for sniper. He would later be identified as Mikhail Goleniewski, a Soviet agent installed in Polish intelligence, but to the CIA, he was simply codenamed Sniper. His letter provided scant but compelling intel on two unidentified British spies, codenamed Lambda 1 and Lambda 2. All Sniper knew for sure was that Lambda 2 was working for British naval intelligence. He thought the name was Horton, which the CIA noted was similar to Harry Houghton, naval intelligence employee. And like Houghton, this spy had previously served in Warsaw. The CIA was convinced Harry Houghton fit the profile. Well, they were right. Harry Houghton, you may recall, was a member of the Kroger spy ring and the source of all the intel they were sending back to Moscow. But Peter and Helen Kroger had no idea about this new threat honing in on their well-oiled espionage machine. They were confident they had the neighbors fooled with their suburban bungalow and charming smiles. But even the best spies can be uncovered when their allies start to go down. Because of the information in Sniper's letters, Harry Houghton was placed under constant surveillance by naval intelligence agents and MI5. They just needed proof that he was a spy before they moved on him, and ideally, all his allies. One July afternoon in 1960, Houghton and Ethel G. were observed at a park, chatting with another gentleman. They handed him a brown shopping bag and received a white envelope in return. Then, the man sped off in a white Studebaker. After running the car's license plates, MI5 determined that it belonged to Gordon Lonsdale. Lonsdale was placed under surveillance as well. Investigators watched Lonsdale like a hawk, noting his every routine. They followed him through traffic, using parallel streets so as not to be seen, and eventually, they noticed that some evenings he broke his routine by driving out of London in a westerly direction. A carefully orchestrated, tedious tailing was initiated, leading officials straight into Ruislip. Coming up, the CIA and MI5 move in on Lonsdale and the Krogers. Now back to the story. It was a crisp autumn day, like any other in 1960. Helen Kroger and her neighbor Ruth Search shared a cup of tea while Ruth's children played in the Kroger's living room. Helen was, as usual, the perfect host. After a while, Ruth begrudgingly got up to leave. She had to get dinner on the table. Helen hugged the children goodbye, and the Searches returned home. Later that night, as Ruth was preparing supper, an unexpected visitor showed up, Jim Skardon of the Security Service. He asked Ruth if he could come in, and nervous and confused, Ruth acquiesced. She showed him to the living room and offered him tea, but he kindly declined. He had come on business. Jim opened his briefcase and took out surveillance photographs, of Gordon Lonsdale. He asked if Ruth or her husband recognized him. They didn't, but they agreed to keep an eye out for him. But that wasn't all. Skardon needed to use an upstairs room of their house to surveil the neighborhood on Saturdays and Sundays. The Searches made a small protest, but Skardon firmly explained that the government wasn't asking for their cooperation as much as demanding it. The Searches had little choice. They allowed police to set up shop in their house, only yards away from the Krogers. But that didn't mean the British operation was seamless. One afternoon in 1960, the entire operation was almost blown. Helen stopped by the Searches unannounced, as neighbors are wont to do. She noticed the purse on the kitchen table, a purse she knew wasn't Ruth's. Helen questioned Ruth about it, and Ruth casually dismissed it as her daughter's. Really, it belonged to one of the officers hiding upstairs. Concealing surveillance from the neighbors who seemed nothing more than a benevolent couple, was proving extremely difficult for Ruth. But the Search family played their part for national security as they were ordered. By January of 1961, police had spent months in their suburban home. The investigation team monitored Gordon Lonsdale's activities, watching him come and go. They noted radio interference in the neighborhood, and correctly surmised it was coming from the Kroger home. The case was building, but it had yet to be cracked. They still couldn't prove Lonsdale's true identity. They'd just have to keep watching and waiting until the time was right. But then, everything changed. The CIA's contact, Sniper, was under suspicion by Moscow. The Soviets might alert Lonsdale and his team to the possible exposure any day, and allowed the agents to escape. The British agents had to act now. On Saturday, January 7th, 1961, Peter and Helen Kroger met Lonsdale for lunch. They shared the microdot letters they'd received from his family in Russia. He gave them a response, which they would microdot and send back. They planned to meet later that evening, as usual. Then, the Krogers returned home to tend to the day's chores, not knowing that, in the meantime, the London Special Branch arrested Houghton, G., and Lonsdale on Waterloo Road. But something about the afternoon did seem strange to Peter. After wrapping up a few books for shipment, he made his way to the post office. He saw Bill Search across the road, washing his car. Peter called out to him, but Bill offered only a short reply. Strange. Normally, Bill would have been much more talkative. Then, out in front of the post office, Peter noticed a radio detector van. Well, these vans occasionally patrolled the neighborhood to ensure that all radio and TV signals were licensed, but this particular van had come down their street for several days now. Peter wondered if their signals were causing noticeable interference. He stifled his anxiety. He was probably overthinking. But then, the most alarming thing of all. When Peter returned home, he noticed strangers walking up and down the road. People he'd never seen before inhabiting their quiet, isolated corner of the London suburbs. Peter began to sweat. Something was terribly wrong. He slipped back into the house to tell Helen what he'd seen. Had they been discovered? Perhaps they should leave, now. They risked their lives if they were caught. But Peter and Helen were loyal to their people and to their cause. They wouldn't leave. They would wait. Surely this was mere paranoia. Surely Lonsdale would be back that night, and it would be business as usual. But the hour came and went, and Lonsdale never arrived. Peter watched the clock nervously. Missing an appointment was entirely out of character for him. Still, they tried to remain calm. They ate dinner, they read, they listened to Radio Moscow in case any of the reports concerned them. And then, the heavy metal knocker at the door sounded. Peter's heart sank. It wasn't Lonsdale, not this late. And it was unlikely that a neighbor would stop by at this hour either. Peter composed himself for a brief moment and then made his way to the door. He braced himself with a sharp breath and turned the handle. The gentleman at the door introduced himself as G.G. Smith, an officer making inquiries. Peter flushed. His fears had been right. He tried to shut the door, but the officer blocked it with his foot. Behind him, Peter could see cars pulling up to the house, the unfamiliar people surrounding them. This was it. This was a raid. Well, so be it. Peter would go down gracefully, like the skilled spy he was. He composed himself and invited the officers in. They asked to see Helen as well. When the Krogers were both present, the superintendent asked for the name of the man who visits them on weekends. The Krogers vaguely replied that they had a lot of friends. He asked them to be more specific. They rattled off a few names, but none of them were Lonsdale. This omission was significant enough to merit detention. Under the Official Secrets Act, Smith could take them into custody for refusing to divulge the name of someone they were suspected of harboring. The Krogers were under arrest. Still, Helen was determined to do her part to protect their work. When they were told to prepare for departure, she made her way over to her purse, turning her back to one of the sergeants. She then asked to use the restroom. The sergeant, finding her behavior suspicious, approved the restroom use, but only with supervision. This foiled Helen's plans. Undeterred, Helen again thought on her feet. She asked to stoke the boiler before they left, since she presumed they'd be away from the house for some time. Why did Helen want to slip away? To flush something down the toilet, or perhaps burn it? Helen hastily closed her coat over her handbag, but the move was too obvious. The detectives yanked her handbag away from her, and after rifling through it, found two glass slides with three microdots sandwiched between them, and a page of Soviet cipher instructions. The game was up. Ethel G., Harry Houghton, Gordon Lonsdale, and the Krogers came to be known as the Portland Five. They went on trial together on March 13, 1961. Lonsdale attempted to assume all of the blame, believing that if they all went to prison, he would be released first in a swap exchange by the Soviet government. He maintained the Krogers knew nothing of his espionage. Peter supported this statement. Helen did as well, though her voice was much less confident than Peter's. She knew what the investigators had found in her purse. After 8 days, the jury came to a verdict in under 2 hours. Each of the five were guilty as charged. Meanwhile, their fingerprints were delivered to the U.S. Embassy in London. They were forwarded to Washington, where the Bureau confirmed they belonged to Morris and Lona Cohen. The Cohens were each sentenced to 20 years in prison. But in 1969, after just 8 years behind bars, the USSR secured their release as part of a prisoner exchange. Morris was 59 years old, Lona was 56. And finally, they were being rewarded by the country they'd spent their lives serving. They received one of the motherland's highest awards, the Order of the Red Banner. The activists turned communist sympathizers were now bona fide Soviet heroes. After their deaths, the couple were even given the posthumous title Hero of the Russian Federation by President Boris Yeltsin. With good reason. Morris and Lona's work saved the USSR years of research during one of the most critical arms races in history. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. For more information on Morris and Lona Cohen, amongst the many sources we used, we found Operation Whisper, the capture of Soviet spies Morris and Lona Cohen by Barnes Carr, extremely helpful. You can find more episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound designed by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Aaron Larson, and Joel Stein. This episode of Espionage was written by Natalie McKieran, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher. I'm Carter Roy.